This is Radio Era Environment, the radio of environmental education. You are listening to the podcast.
Your voice at COP27.
Kosibi, what do you think?
Yeah, I've heard about my two colleagues, and I want to be less pessimistic in terms of not throwing the baby in the water. You know, the net zero might not be the right solution, and we all agree on, because we've been talking about net zero like for the last three years, but nothing seriously is happening on the ground. However, ideally, the objective is to put in place kind of mechanisms that will help the countries, especially developed countries and also developing countries, to progressively reduce the greenhouse gases emissions. So it might not be totally negative, it might not be totally useless, but yes, it's important to reach the point where we start implementing the net zero on the ground. So I remember again, you know, in Glasgow, the debate around phase out and phase down. And I consider the net zero program as another way to approve the phase out rather than the phase down. So, of course, again, this is not yet happening concretely. So no one can touch any project that might lead, and we've all heard about, we heard the speech of the President Biden the last time, who was like, I'm standing here as President of America and I'm saying that US is going to achieve its NDC, which is like something really. We know how people hide themselves behind policies, behind mechanisms to say we have. So as my brother say, it's a matter of mathematics. But I will not throw the program out. I will just call countries, I will just call these leaders, decision makers, to start implementing the net zero. And the net zero, again, cannot be implemented without all the actors. And I'm thinking of civil society organizations who can play a critical role on the ground in terms of implementing net zero. But beyond this, I also want to call our decision makers, especially in the southern part, to not fully rely on developed countries in terms of fighting climate change. So it's important that we show that we are the victims of the problem, and we take, of course, some national responsibility in terms of having at least 1% of our national budget for climate change. Why not? We do not have anything, and we are like waiting for the others to come and solve the problem. I think we pass by that step, and we need to go further by showing that yes, you are responsible of the problem, but we are also responsible of our communities, and we need to protect them. So we are doing our best to protect our community with our limited budget, and I believe that will be seen as an evidence to push the developed countries to act accordingly, rather than sitting and always claiming for money.
Because we actually mentioned the resilience of the community. Fatima, how do you see net zero as a researcher? How do you see net zero for the youth, as Nino said, that it won't be actually affecting the people that are us, because we actually are here, but we don't know if in 2030, 2050 we will be there. So the youth, for instance, is there any responsibility in this carbon, in this net zero, and what do you think as a researcher in terms of understanding this and translate it to the community?
Yeah, so I do agree with the comments that's been made that from an intergenerational equity perspective, you know, there are huge burdens that lay ahead for youth, especially if we don't try to address those problems now. But I have a tendency to say that net zero will be net zero if we don't get some of the transitional levers in place. So for me, research is a critical part of it. We really need to understand what are some of the implications of the new energy resources that we're talking about. I mean, hydrogen isn't new, but to some extent we need to understand what are the implications of an expansion, a deployment, a high penetration of hydrogen if we're going to move to that. So one of the things that we were doing at United Nations University's Institute for Natural Resources in Africa is we started a program called After Carbon, because we believe that the net zero itself is a definitional issue. I mean, we don't all have the same understanding of what net zero means. And net zero also reflects a power asymmetry. It means that some people have the ability and, you know, the power to basically orient the direction of travel. They're going to be telling us how we go, where we go, and what sectors we need to pay more attention to in achieving net zero. So what we're saying is basically the assumption that arriving at net zero would need some preparation, it would need some planning. And so we've got an initiative called After Carbon, and the idea is to basically say, okay, what are some of the most compelling post-carbon issues that we need to understand better? Moving a little bit away from the NDCs, because I think that the NDCs are going to take a long time to be able to implement, and they're not going to implement themselves, they have to be implemented. But I feel that there is a deficit in implementation right now. So we want to basically say there are ways we can get to that transition quicker. And one of the ways of doing that is understanding what is on the radar of policymakers. Rather than starting from research as a vantage point, we are starting from policy. And by starting from policy, we're polling some of the most compelling policy challenges related to net zero. And once these are polled from different sectors, we've chosen three sectors, agriculture, energy, and cities. Once we poll these questions, we're basically going to now work with researchers, work with private sector in a kind of matchmaking platform. So the platform has got policymakers, private sector, researchers, and civil society. And we're going to be able to actually see how do we then bring solutions to some of these problems, and how do we do it with other stakeholders on that platform, so that it kind of goes in a revolving way, whereby it starts from the policymaker, it travels a little bit further to the scientists and the academics that are part of the platform. The private sector has a hand in it, because they need to be able to understand what is the policy, what's the regulation that will make some of these solutions work. And to some extent, civil society is a little bit of a moral watchdog as well. They have their word to say. But the long and short of it for me is net zero has to be fully indigenized. I have a feeling that even as we're talking about just transition and net zero, these are words that we're talking about, but they're not our words. We don't understand it from the same vantage point. Our contextual realities are somewhat different. And even, I think, from a global north, net zero doesn't mean net zero.
Yeah.
You know. So it's important that the global north doesn't place a disproportionate burden on the global south by offloading their mitigation burden on us. Because they have a bigger mitigation burden, but they are defining how we get there. They are defining measurements in terms of how we get there. And they are even defining the sectors that are, you know, most ready for net zero. And I feel that if we're not able to put in our own definition, our own contextual realities, then it's going to be hugely difficult, because they'll be doing this with our blessings, you know, by omission, because we're not opposing what they're saying. So there has to be some sort of oppositional, I think, value that we place on net zero, to basically say, you know, we have a development imperative. A development imperative means that we need to really look at how we manage our exit out of fossil fuel. We will have to manage, we will have to get out of fossil fuel. There's no denying of that. But we cannot get out overnight. It has to be managed. One of the work we've been doing quite a lot is on stranded assets. And we don't get to talk about that a lot, because there are countries in Africa that are hydrocarbon rich, and these countries would also have to basically start thinking about their plan and their vision towards managing their exit out of fossil fuel.
You mentioned South Africa?
We talk about South Africa, we talk about Namibia, we talk about Nigeria, Algeria, Egypt, Niger even, you know. So these are all countries that are resource rich. But the problem is that they've been actually, a lot of their economies have been very reliant on the revenue that they get from these resources. And these resources, I mean, you mentioned that there is divestment, but the companies are also divesting away from fossil fuel, except that we're now seeing some sort of a dual trend. There's divestment, but there's also, they're investing as well. So prior to COVID, there's been some divestment away from fossil fuel. But we're now seeing, I mean, coal, for instance, was a fuel that for a long time, I assume, was going to just die its natural death. But that's not happening. Instead, coal is now being used as a substitute because of the fact that natural gas is so, well, it was contested, but with the Ukrainian war, we're seeing that many countries are going back to natural gas. And I think that the point that you made also, I mean, in Mozambique, there is a situation whereby we are seeing support that's given to the Mozambican government on two fronts. One in terms of the exploitation of natural gas, and the other support is in terms of security. Because the natural gas, where it is actually, is an area where there is a sense that the Islamists in that area, and as you were saying, it probably wasn't a security risk or threat, but there are Islamist groups in that area where there's a sense that they might be able to lay hands on the natural gas infrastructure in Mozambique. So there is support to the Mozambican government from a security perspective to protect that area. But the irony is that a couple of months ago, this was a no-go area. Africa was being implicitly told not to exploit natural gas. There was some sort of tacit embargo on natural gas, because there was a sense that you have all this arsenal of renewable energies. Why are you not taking advantage of it? Why do you want to go into natural gas that has safety issues, potential leakages, infrastructure that is not in place? You'll have to build all of that, and it will take you at least 30 years. But there's been a radical U-turn because of the fact that there's a sense that, okay, there are homes in England, homes in Germany that are going to be without heating, you know? And that is something that cannot be stomached.
How do you see it? How do you see it? Because Fatima said that actually what is affecting the north is affecting the south, in a sense that actually the policy was on renewable energy in Africa, and now with all of this context in Europe, it has to change. How do you see it? How do you see it as a civil society?
I think she's very right, and probably the war in Ukraine is showing us that nothing is for granted. Things can change, and these developed countries can also maybe experiment some of the difficulties that we are going through. In the southern part, to shift their mindset and also ask the right questions, because sometimes that's the problem. Are we asking the right question? But I also want to say that and come back on the net zero. You know, it's first of all for me a tool that the northern part of the world should use, because when we talk about mitigation, yes. The southern part has a role to play, but the most important rely on the developed country. And if the net zero can help them to structure, organize, and orient the process to get to cleaner energy, to get to less pollution, because net zero doesn't mean zero, as someone said already, that's fine. So let us, again, don't blame the program, but just help our government. And you know, sometimes I want to say our government, our leaders, they don't take wrong decision. They just take decision based on the information that they have. So we need to provide them with the right information. We need to talk to them. We need to share with them our experience from the field, because this is where we are getting the evidence from. And probably the things can be better. That's what I want to add. So again, Dr. Fatima is like, you know, she's part of the topic, and she has been on the ground for many, many years, and she mapped the situation so well that, yeah, nothing to add. Thank you.
Back to the community, Nimo, how do you translate all of the things we did related to zero carbon, to the understanding on climate change, the understanding of climate change solution, the resilience from loss and damage in local language.
You like to ask difficult questions, but you know, I hope I remember. But I really want to say
something.
I want to say something first of all about the switch in Europe from abandoning fossils to looking for fossils, and also the response from Africa, because I think it has a very colonial connotation. The idea of Africa, African governments, like the Nigerian vice president, have written an article explaining why Africa must go on fossils. The ministers from Equatorial Guinea have said it over and over again, Africa must develop with fossil fuels. The president of Uganda wrote an article in the Telegraph of UK about why Africa must develop, must use fossil fuels. And I do understand that dilemma, but I don't also think that African leaders lack information. We've got, they just lack, they don't have our own analysis. They have a different analysis. But they want, they have what they're looking for and they go for it. We've got African leaders who had similar analysis to us, someone like Thomas Sankara was an African leader. Mm-hmm. He had the analysis that we, from our perspective, but they killed him. We had Lumumba, who was speaking for Africa, and they killed him. We've got Samora Machel, we've got many leaders, both in office and outside of office, like Steve Biko, who spoke about the African personality, African person, humanity. So we have our leaders choose what they want to parrot and what they want to sell. Now, Europe said, we're going to move to the Red Bull. And now the war came, the war, Russian war in Ukraine came up. And Europe now says, we can't afford to stay without gas. And we're going to grab gas. And Africa becomes the sacrificial zone. And our leaders are saying, we must extract gas and oil. Without this, how can we develop? But how much of that is going to develop Africa? Nothing. Nothing. Because if you look at the map of Africa, check the infrastructure map, all the maps right now, from Uganda, the pipeline is taking the oil to Tanzania for what? For export. The gas from Nigeria is going to go from Niger Delta to Morocco to where? To Europe. So meant for export. The Niger Delta remains in darkness. In darkness, apart from the gas flare, which doesn't give everybody's light. They're not going to have light from. So they're not going to have the power, the energy. And of course, what I'm saying is that our politicians are seizing the opportunity to grab cash. Cash, not to provide energy for Africans, not to develop the continent. We've got hundreds of years of export-based kind of economy. That's why we have plantations in Africa. Plantations were not meant for Africa, but for export. So you have cocoa plantation, rubber plantation, oil palm plantation, whatever plantation is all for export.
This is Radio Era Environnement. The radio of environmental education.